This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, very interesting guest today. Man from Down Under, Bruce Hawker, is an Australian political strategist and commentator. He was a strategist in a series of election campaigns for, among others, Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, where he also served as political director. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
You're here in the U.S. You're producing a documentary titled Trump's America, and you're visiting four states.
Well, we'll probably end up visiting more. But right now, obviously, we're in Arizona. We're off to South Carolina soon. We'll be in Washington for some of the time.
D.C.
Yes. Wisconsin. And then we'll be taking a road trip across as far as Pennsylvania and West Virginia. So there'll be quite
a few. Minnesota was in the mix.
Minnesota. Yeah, Minnesota's very much in the mix. We think it's going to be an exciting place for us to go.
Yeah, interesting selection. The logic, you have specific logic of those. I think they're great. You know, if I were to pick four or five states, those are pretty good ones.
Yes. Well, we realized when we looked at things that America is an incredibly diverse country. It's not homogenous in the way, say, Australia is. And so we had to work out where we could go in a short period of time, 5 weeks, which best reflected the various characters of America. So Arizona, obviously, very important because of its proximity to Mexico and issues that we can discuss here. South Carolina, because it's in the South and they have their own raft of issues, both historical and contemporary.
We are still fighting the Civil War. Most people forget that or didn't know, don't recognize it, but it's still there.
We'll bear that in mind when we're there. And of course, Minnesota being in the far north, and a state which I think we're going to see a lot of contest in.
And by the way, I'd just interject in that one. That was a state most people didn't notice when Trump carried the upper Midwest. It did not include Minnesota, but he only missed by half a point. So it's very much a swing state.
Yeah, so he'll be in there fighting. And then, of course, we're very interested in the Midwest and moving across to, I guess, what you might call the Rust Belt states, where the Democrats did so poorly in the last presidential campaign, particularly Pennsylvania. Yeah. And I think if we do that, we'll get a good sense of where Americans are today. We're not really interested in what's happening in LA. We're not really concerned about New York. We know what's going to happen there. But we do want to know what's happening in these other very important parts of America that Australian audiences see very little of and know even less about.
Well, I when I heard about this enterprise, one of the things I first thought of was in the early 19th century, Alexis de Tocqueville came to America. This French guy wrote what for about two centuries was considered the definitive work on American culture and American politics. And most people feel that you had to not be an American in order to do that. You have to be from the outside to recognize things that within a country you might take as a given. So given that background and high bar, you've been to southern Arizona, you've been to the border, been to Tucson, come up here. Any impressions so far that hold?
Well, we are very interested in the wall. Because if you ask any Australian or probably any international observer, you know, what was the first thing that you heard about when you saw Donald Trump in 2015, 2016? It was this talk about the need for a wall. And, you know, naively, I didn't think there was a wall there anyway, you know, that there was just a very small border. But, of course, this issue of the wall has been around for a long time in Arizona, as we now know. And to some extent, we think that, you know, when it comes to immigration issues, Arizona might be something of a microcosm for what's actually been happening more recently in wider America as issues of immigration and border security become more and more in the forefront of the public debate. So coming here, we're seeing two things down there, particularly around the border area. You know, we've spoken to people who are associated with the ranching community, you know, who are much more concerned about seeing that there's border security right on the border and not allowing illegal immigrants to come across.
Those are actually folks crossing their property, which is quite different from what somebody in Phoenix might feel.
Exactly. They feel like they're on the front line. And then you have people like the mayor of Douglas, who we spoke to, who has to deal with a large Latino population and a close relationship with a sister city across the other side of the border. How do you deal with that? And how do you try to, you know, reduce some of the negative impact of increased security measures, increased restrictions on travel, which apparently in the early stages of the Trump presidency actually had a significant impact on that local community in terms of sales taxes and other services.
Yeah, what a lot of people don't realize is there are lots and lots of Mexicans in border towns who cross to the U.S. to shop and then come back. That's Douglas. That's also Nogales, of which there's a Nogales, Arizona, and a Nogales, Mexico. And there's a very symbiotic relationship there. There's almost anything that you buy, and I say this I go to Mexico all the time, almost anything that is manufactured in any sense is much cheaper in the U.S.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah.
The reverse is true. If you want fresh fruits and vegetables, you buy that on the Mexican side. But even in a grocery store, a box of cereal is way more expensive in Mexico than the U.S. because it's food, but it's manufactured food.
Yeah. So I guess what we're seeing there is that if you live close to the border, you've probably been more used to this to and fro. But you're also affected more negatively if someone comes across your land. We heard stories of a murder that took place of a rancher some years ago, which galvanized public opinion in the border region. You can understand that. You can understand also why you don't want to see people coming across the border loaded up with drugs.
Yeah.
All those are real concerns.
Yeah. And the other thing that's a factor now is that the composition of people crossing the border has changed. Net migration from Mexico is now zero. There's as many going south as going north. Mm. The people crossing the border tend to be Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, where they're in the midst of – they've got gang issues and civil war issues.
And that's interesting because in Australia we have this issue about refugees and asylum seekers as well. Mm-hmm. And once again, public opinion is very strong on this issue and divided. But I think a majority of people in Australia are concerned about people coming in as refugees or claiming refugee status, which may or may not be legitimate, usually through boats coming from the northern and from Indonesia and Malaysia.
I'd like to pick that up. We're going to go to a break right now, but I'd like to pick that up when we come back talking about, because there's a lot of parallels here. You've got immigration issues in Australia, and how that has been managed there would be very fascinating to talk about when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back with Bruce Hawker, Australian political strategist. We were talking about some of the parallels between our two countries. The issue of immigration has also played a role. I know I forget the exact time, several decades ago, Australia had a very restrictive immigration policy and then kind of flipped completely on that.
We did. We had what they called the White Australia policy. They were pretty unapologetic about what they intended, and that was you only had white immigration to Australia. And that effectively operated until 1972 when a Labor government was elected, and they changed that, and we became a multicultural country in a pretty short period of time. Mm-hmm. That made big changes to the way in which people lived in Australia. And of course, to a lot of older people, it was quite a stark experience.
I imagine. I've met a lot of Asian Australians, and I said, well, this isn't the Australia of old.
No, it definitely is not. And of course, you've had a political response to that, too, from certain sections of the community. Parties have arisen, usually small marginal parties, mm-hmm. which have been very opposed to more immigration. Mm-hmm. But
smallish?
Smallish, yes. Mm-hmm. But the major parties will seize on this issue from time to time. And in one election just after 2001, after the 9/11 mm-hmm. Atrocities, a a government was looking to lose the election, and it was a conservative government, and a boatload of refugees were coming to Australia from the northern waters. They were usually from the Middle East and other parts of Asia and Middle East, and they would come fly usually to Malaysia and Indonesia, and then take very small and unsafe boats across the waters to Australia. A lot of these boats were so unseaworthy that they were falling apart. And in one instance, a big tanker picked up a lot of these people in the water and started to take them to Australia, and they were turned around by the Australian government. It was an election looming, and it was a very divisive issue, but it worked as a wedge issue against a lot of working class Australians who were looking to
job fears.
Yeah, job fears, and the result of that was that unexpectedly, that government won that election with a very famous quote from the Prime Minister at the time, which was, "We decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they do," and so ever since then. The issue of refugees and people perhaps coming seeking refugee status when they're not legitimate refugees has been a big issue between the Labor Party on the left and the Liberal Party, which is really the Conservative Party, on the right. And most people tend to break more towards the Conservatives on this issue.
What is the non-white population of Australia now?
Well, it's still very small. A good 80% of the Australian population would come from a European background.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that's if it was zero, I mean, that's still a big cultural change over essentially a generation.
It's
much bigger, for example, than the increase that we're seeing, even though the Mexican Hispanic population in this country is increasing. That's a bigger change.
A bigger change in a shorter period. And it's something which we're seeing in Europe as well mass exodus of people out of places like Syria and North Africa is changing the politics in Europe as well. It's had that effect in Australia to some extent. Mm-hmm. But still, the major parties tend to try to keep a bit of a lid on it. They don't try to overstate it. And, of course, there are significant migrant communities in Australia who, you know, you have to be careful about offending with some of that sort of rhetoric. All sorts of things have happened. You know, obviously, we've become a much more more diverse community, a much more interesting community in many ways because we've got all these people from all around the world living with us. Mm-hmm. But there has been some ghettoizing of parts of major cities like Sydney, which we don't think is necessarily a healthy thing, but tends to happen when you've got big population movements in a reasonably short period of time.
How long is the path to citizenship for an immigrant?
It can be several years. You know, it can be up to 10 years. Mm-hmm. My brother, for example, is married to a Thai woman. They've got two children. But she's still, after about 5 years living in Australia, still hasn't managed to
even achieve. Marrying.
Marrying an Australian does not guarantee you citizenship in the first instance because, frankly, there are a lot of people who are marrying out of convenience in order to gain citizenship. So that's not allowed. You have to go through all sorts of tests, including
proving that it's a legitimate marriage and that sort of. Well, that's the same here.
Yeah.
In fact, they're pretty rigorous about that.
Yeah, and they are in Australia too. So it's tightening up. But but once you do become an Australian citizen, you're entitled to all the benefits of citizenship.
And voting. And what I was really getting at was the issue of voting, because if the path is short, these immigrants become a voting group, and then that changes the politics.
It does. But they don't necessarily always vote with one party. Depending on the country they come from, their politics can be very different. For a long time in Australia, even before 1972, we had a large influx of migrants from Eastern Europe. And they tended to be very right-wing in their politics because they were reacting to the communist regime.
Sure.
And they supported the Liberal Party, whereas migrants from other countries.
And the Liberal Party is the Conservative Party. That's why I jumped in.
The conservative out there.
And that's true of most of the world, that liberal is the more conservative because the left-wing party is the Labor Party.
Exactly. And so that tends to have a more social democratic connotation about it, more directed towards a welfare welfare state orientation and a closer association.
So social democratic is left wing, and then Christian democratic is usually from the right.
Exactly right.
Most of Europe.
So,
what other observations? What strikes you in terms of differences between the countries?
Well, apart from this remarkable diversity in the United States, I think the fact that your politics is played out at a very aggressive level in election campaigns. Just watching the TV coverage over the last few nights, I watched one ad break where there were six ads and five of them were political, and all of them were negative. Highly negative. Yep. And I think that in terms of the political culture, even though Australia still has a pretty robust give and take, I think American politics has taken it to another level. And of course, you tend to be working more to your base all the time, trying to excite the feelings of either the Democratic base or the Republican base.
The latter is a relatively recent phenomena, and we have become so polarized that for all intents and purposes, the middle disappears. The old admonition used to be run to the left or to the right in your own primary to get the nomination and then race to the middle.
Yes.
And there's a question of whether or not there's a middle left.
Well, to race to, yes.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the things that we're looking at is to what extent Americans are now a bit fatigued from what's happening in the Trump administration. Is there too much division?
We'll pick that up when we conclude, or when we come back, discussing Australian American politics in the think tank on KTR.
He lives somewhere out on the track, Mac, so take me koala back all together now.
Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down. Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down.
Let me abos go loose, Lou. Let me abos go loose. They're of no further use, Lou. So let me abos go loose all together.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Bruce Hawker, an Australian political strategist, was former aide to our Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. I want to run through you kind of a list of things where there are interesting differences between the U.S. and Australia. And I think, by the way, the starting point with, there's a lot of common history. We are both countries where essentially Europeans came and you have a frontier mentality.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
A democratic tradition that emanated from England. But there are several interesting departures in political culture, one of which is that Australia has something that I think would be jarring to most Americans, compulsory voting. How and when did that come about and to what effect?
Well, compulsory voting came about in the early 20th century and not, as a lot of people think, as a result of the Labor Party introducing it, but because conservative parties were worried that the labor movement was getting well organized. And so the unions were getting their members out to vote in elections when ordinary middle class Australians weren't going.
Just the opposite.
So it was the conservatives that introduced compulsory voting in Australia in the early 20th century.
So it's been a longstanding part of history then.
It is. And it's also pretty much undebated now. It's accepted as being part and parcel of our political system. And it suits both major parties for it to be like that. But it does make for some very interesting differences in the way in which we campaign and the way in which policy is developed as well. Because as you were saying before, in the United States, politics is all about agitating your base, as we see demonstrated so well by Donald Trump. You must get your own people out to vote. In Australia, we almost take our traditional supporters for granted. We're looking at the middle ground all the time. The people who have got one foot in the conservative camp and one foot in the labor camp may change from election to election. They tend to be people who, like the status quo. And so our politics tends to be more consensus driven. Even though we talk about being very different in our approaches, there are certain things in policy rollout which are untouchable. For example, our national health system. Mm-hmm. If the Conservatives were to try to walk away from our national health scheme, which covers everybody, then they would be voted out of office tomorrow. Because even well-to-do people see that as being a very important part of our culture.
And we're at, a transition point on that. I think that what happened when Obamacare got put in, I think it created an irreversible phenomena. There was an immediate sense attempt to repeal it. It failed. I think what you're going to get now at most is tinkering around the edges because and I'm seeing this in the politics right now, people who tried to somehow curtail Obamacare by, for example, allowing people with pre-existing conditions to pay more. That's the beginning of unraveling. They are paying a price.
Yeah.
They're being attacked for that. And inevitably we'll see some tinkering around the edges. But basically, healthcare has been provided for a much wider pool of people. And I tend to think that that's I can't think of any country that has ever expanded that franchise that ever successfully subsequently contracted it. You can argue about the details about how you do it, and there's certainly a lot of the American healthcare system that makes it exorbitantly expensive, and there may be efforts to deal with that. But as far as throwing people out of healthcare on massive numbers, it's hard to see that happening. And I look to not only the United States, I look to the rest of the entire developed world, with Australia, Britain, the entire continent of Europe. It's basically an untouchable article of faith.
Indeed.
And as is in the United States, Social Security.
Yes.
Which was put in the Roosevelt era and has since become completely untouchable, including to conservative Republicans. I mean, one of the most damning things that a Democratic candidate can say against a Republican, well, you're trying to undermine Social Security. And that's, that's an article. And the irony is, of course, that Social Security is inherently social. It is a socialist idea.
Indeed.
And we think we don't like that. But when it's providing benefits, it turns out that at a policy level, we're actually fine with that.
Yeah, indeed. And you find the money somehow to do it because
there'll be a
reaction against it. And it makes, I would argue, for a better society, a more cohesive society. We don't really want to descend into a system where the haves and the have-nots are so far apart from one another that they don't feel like they're inhabiting the same political system.
So back to compulsory voting. Now, I assume nothing actually gets under. What kind of percent do you actually end up getting?
Oh, you get in the high 90s.
High 90s.
And
so it's pretty virtually universal.
Yeah. So anyone can turn up at the polling place, have their name struck off on the list and go and spoil their ballot and put it into the box, not actually vote.
You could throw in a blank ballot or something. But you have to be there. You have to.
Yeah, you have to go. Otherwise, you will be fined. And
how much of a fine?
I think it's like a couple of $100.
Enough to get your attention.
Yeah, it is. And there are some places where it sort of it drops lower. In the Northern Territory, which has got a high Aboriginal population, Indigenous population, it can be harder to locate all the communities in order to have them voting on the day. So there's more flexibility there.
Do you vote by mail?
Yes, you can, and you can vote by postal vote and by early voting as well. You're meant to have a reason to do that. But that has also changed the way in which campaigning happens in Australia, of course, because up to 30% of the people are casting their vote before Election Day.
And we have that too in the state of Arizona, and it's changed our politics a lot. The voting starts basically within the next day or two.
Yeah.
As soon as the mailing went out this week. So it
changes the way you campaign. Yeah.
Well, among other things, to contrast it with the U.S., not only do we not have compulsory voting, we have pre-registration required. In some states, you can register on Election Day, but not in most states. Voter ID requirements, polling places only in certain places, polling people that move may find themselves unregistered because you're in a different district. Your registration no longer counts. Over-incarceration and restriction of voting from prior felons, which runs into the millions. It's not a small number. And what I call voluntary suppression, not voting by choice. There's a lot of obstacles to voting in this country.
It's interesting. And when it's done deliberately, I think that's a terrible thing. Because I think we should be trying to encourage people to participate in the democratic system. I mean, in the United States, the greatest democracy in the world, in my opinion, it should be there to encourage people to vote at all the times. But it becomes a political strategy.
And sometimes a political strategy is to deliberately suppress the vote of those who are opposed to you. If you can somehow make them turned off enough that they won't vote, that's part of the political strategy. Not unlike you mentioned negative campaigning. The sad fact is that it works. And that's why including people who say that people say they hate negative campaigning. And then you ask them I wouldn't vote for them because of this, this and this. And they parrot back what they've heard.
Indeed. I mean, I as a campaigner myself, I've sat in focus groups and shown them positive ads and negative ads. And they're appalled at the negative ad. And they say, well, at the end of it, well, what did it do? So that negative ad really changed my mind about candidate X.
Well, he's a scumbag, so I wouldn't vote for him. But
So it's not just the poor politicians. Yeah. They're encouraged by the electorate to do these things.
One more thing I would like to talk about. We have just a minute or two. Instant runoff voting. You have a system whereby people select not only first choice, but second choice. And I look at that and I said, well, the impact of that is you, for example, could see people in this country say, you know, I'm a Green Party advocate, but you know, if I vote green, I may elect the Republican, whereas all of their votes would almost usually go to Democrats. Conversely, libertarian votes would second choice would be Republican.
Yeah, indeed. And so people do rail a little bit against that in Australia. But once again, it's part and parcel of our system. And it avoids the need for a runoff election where people are going to already been eliminated and you're going to have to perhaps vote for your second choice.
And let me just take a minute to explain, because I'm sure a lot of people don't know what that is. You would pick your first choice. And if your first choice comes in last on the balloting, then your vote gets reallocated in the second round to your second choice. So you get the opportunity to have an expressive vote, say, for a minority party candidate without having the effect of that being to elect the person that you like the least.
Exactly. And what happens at the polling places is that the political parties have volunteers handing out what they call how to vote cards, which have the suggested order of voting according to their preferences.
So the libertarians might say, all right, vote for us. But then, you know, if we get limited, make your second choice the Republican.
Exactly. So. And so as long as you've got people who can get to the polling place to hand out those cards, that will reflect largely the intention of the political party. When we scrutineer in elections, you'll see people just voting the ticket constantly. But so, it doesn't tend to make too much difference to the way in which elections are decided. It just means that on the day they're decided, and sometimes there's a higher level of informality in the vote if people get their numbers wrong. You know, they vote 1-2-2-4.
Theoretically, it should make no difference. But in practice, when you have a runoff, it can sometimes change the dynamics.
Indeed. Yeah. You know? And I don't think preferential voting of itself is the most critical thing in the world. But first past the post voting can also create some reasonably anomalous results as well. If somebody wins an election with 35-36% of the vote, because
that one stings in Arizona. Those of us been around here long enough remember Ev Meacham elected governor with 30 some odd percent of the vote. And the interesting thing, and I told you this in the break, but for our readers who haven't been here that long, he is elected with 38%. It's a entirely fractious period. He ends up getting impeached. But so the legislature refers to the voters a proposal. Next time we need a majority vote, we need a majority. And in the very next election, Terry Goddard runs against Fife Symington. Fife Symington gets something like 49.8%. Terry Goddard gets 49.7%. And we have to have a meaningless runoff where, lo and behold, Fife Symington wins again by a fraction of a point. In other words, replicating the vote we'd already had. You know, I think the answer you could have come up with, but nobody could have justified, is, all right, you need at least, say, 45% or something. But
exactly,
of course, any number like that other than the majority will be arbitrary.
But the truth is, there are any way, there are all sorts of paths to a democratic outcome. Yeah. Around the world, there are and around the democratic world, there are all sorts of ways of electing governments. And they're flawed in some ways, and they're effective in others.
I think pretty hard to find one that's as flawed as either the Electoral College or the other thing that's ensconced in our system is states having two senators each. That includes California with like 50 times the population of Wyoming. And, you know, pretty hard to find historical anomaly. And it's owing to the fact that it's 200 years old and wasn't as big a deal then. We will return with Bruce Hawker and want to talk about two things that are also interesting about the U.S. and Australian contrast. One is guns, and the other is minimum wage, when we return for a final segment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Australian political strategist Bruce Hawker talking about differences between the two countries' political culture. One really dramatic difference, and this doesn't go back historically, but the difference in, I think you had, it's fair to say Australia probably had a gun culture not unlike the U.S., frontier mentality and the like. But there was a dramatic event and a dramatic political response to it. I wonder if you could take us through that.
Well, you're quite right. It was very common for Australian families, even suburban families, to have a rifle in the house because Dad would take them shooting out in the country. We've got a lot of country and a lot of things people like
to
shoot.
You've got more outback than we have.
Yeah, we've got a lot of outback. If you want any outback, come to Australia. Yeah. That's the place. But in 1996, there was a terrible massacre, a gun massacre, at a place called Port Arthur in Tasmania. And Port Arthur was one of the first convict settlements in Australia. It's an historic site now. And this gunman, for reasons best known to himself, used a number of automatic weapons to shoot 35 people dead around the area. They were tourist operators, and about 23 were wounded as well. It was an horrific event by any standards, and it changed overnight the way in which Australians perceived guns. As a result of that, the Prime Minister of the day, who is a conservative, and one would expect that a man of that background not to have been taken on the issue, decided that we actually had to do something very serious about it. And so he got the states together because guns are regulated by states rather than by the federal government. And they reached a consensus. And the consensus was that basically automatic, semi-automatic weapons had to be handed back in by members of the public. A gun amnesty was announced. And as a result of that, literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of weapons were returned to police stations all around the country. What that did to the murder rate for guns was absolutely incredible. They've done research on this, yeah. And in 1996, I can't remember the exact number of people that were killed by guns, but 72%. A drop between then and 2014 in the number of gun killings it deliberately inflicted on other people, murders. So it's been a very dramatic impact on the way in which the gun culture has operated and been perceived in Australia.
And I must say, as a trained social scientist, that is about as convincing a what we call natural social experiment as you will find anywhere. It's what you call interrupted time. You've got a time series, so many murders every year. Then you have a significant intervening event, and it's hard to find anything else that of that dramatic nature that could have been a causal factor. And then a radical drop in the murder rate. And, you know, if you're looking for convincing evidence, you're not going to find anything at that level, because normally – in a real-life setting, you're not allowed to manipulate variables to that extent.
Yeah. And I think in 2015, there were 35 people died by gunshot murder in Australia. It's a very small number.
And that number before that was?
It was in the hundreds. Mm-hmm. And there'd been a number of massacres, too, in the 1980s and 1990s, which had affected public opinion, but had not got to the point where the country decided that it was time to make sure that these weapons were handed back in.
I have two possible suggestions that as to how it may have been. One, I'm guessing a parliamentary system probably could be more responsive to public opinion.
Yes.
Because we
had
a lot of public opinion for restrictions on guns in this country, but it doesn't seem to matter. Yep. And number two, I'm guessing that you don't have a lobby group anywhere near the influence of our NRA.
We don't. We do have a party called the Shooters and Fishers Party in Australia, which does attract a small percentage of support, larger in country areas, but they're more an upper house party, a party that will manage to get a small quota of votes in the legislative councils to have some influence. But we don't have a strong view in Australia that guns should be allowed in houses and homes without the most strict controls. You can have gun licenses, but they have to be very closely monitored and regulated. You have to have armory arrangements in place, and they are usually restricted to farmers, to security personnel.
It sounds like people have to demonstrate a need.
Exactly.
Whereas in this country, it is considered a right, period.
And you've got a historical reason for that. You've got your constitution.
Yes.
Now, you could argue about whether the founding fathers really anticipated the sort of weaponry that you're using these days.
I believe they were thinking of muskets.
And of course, that's and it also goes to the nature of politics in the United States, I guess, when you lobby groups like the NRA can exert such incredible power.
We got just a minute left, and I said I'd deal with this. You also have a minimum wage. Minimum wage in the U.S. is a little over $7 an hour, more in some states, including Arizona. Australian minimum wage in U.S. dollars is about $14 an hour.
Yes, it's a solid underpinning, I guess, for most people. So that if you are on the minimum wage in Australia, then you're probably earning about 700 Australian dollars a week, which is manageable.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really where we are on the minimum wage, where people struggle.
Supported? Widely supported?
Yes.
Okay. Website. You want to give us a website? We're running out of time.
Anyone wants to follow our travels around Trump's America, go to ahardroad.com, where you'll see a daily report on our activities, including this fascinating interview with you, Mike.
Okay. Bruce Hawker, thank you very much. And by the way, you can see or listen to all of our old shows at mikeoneal.org or ktar.com. See you next week in the Think Tank.
Down came a jumbuck to drink at the billabong. Up jumped the swagman and grabbed him with glee. He sang as he shoved that jumbuck in his tucker bag. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me.